Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live for an hour each weekday afternoon. We have an open phone line for the entire hour. We have no commercial breaks. We just take calls for the whole hour. And as far as I know, we're the only program on the air anywhere that does that. But you're welcome to join us. I'm always happy to tell you, as I can right now, that there are a couple of lines open. Many times we start the show and I say, well, there's no lines open, but call later. There might be. Right now there are a couple lines open. If you want to get through, if you have questions about the Bible or the Christian faith, or you want to register a disagreement with the host on something that you've heard on the air, you're welcome to join us at this number, 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. And so we'll go right to the phone lines and talk to Shirley from Gardinale. Alaska, right?
No, Arkansas.
Arkansas, okay. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Okay. There's an issue going on in my church that's about to call a split, and I respect your opinion, and I called to ask it. Our pastor thinks that they're being falsely accused. Our elder thinks that we need to not have their music. He thinks that Hillsong and Bethel are associated with NAR and that they use demonic powers. What do you know anything about Hillsong and Bethel and NAR, and what is the truth?
Well, you know, that would require real investigation to really sort out between one claim and another. Hillsong's music out of Australia it has a lot in common with the NAR, and NAR has their own music. Hillsong has their own music, but I'm sure there's a lot of slosh over back and forth because they have very similar ideas and very similar kinds of music. Hillsong, of course, went through some scandals not so very long ago. The founder of the church that was the oversight of the original Hillsong was Frank Houston, and he was taken down on accusations of child molesting. His son then, I think, started the Hillsong Church, the original one, and I can't say much about what his character is. I think there were some allegations against him, but I don't remember exactly. You hear things. Some of these things are well established. Some of them, there's TV documentaries about them. There was a New York City Hillsong Church where the pastor there certainly had to quit in disgrace because of also sinful behavior. So, you know, the thing about these, now I don't know that NAR has had this same kind of problem. NAR is up in Bethel, California. I don't know of any scandals among the ministers there, but I don't know that there aren't any. I don't pay as much attention to it as some do. I get news, you know, and so forth. Hey, we need that background turned off. So all I can say is there's a lot in common. They have a lot in common.
Okay, well, if the songs are okay, is it unethical to use their songs in your church?
I don't think it's wrong to use songs by a songwriter whose Christian experience you don't share or you don't agree with. There's a very famous hymn, I will not name it, because it's a big blessing to a lot of people, that was written by a man that later backslid. And someone on a stagecoach showed him the words of the hymn, not knowing who he was, and saying, aren't these beautiful words, this hymn? And he said, I'm the one who wrote that, and I wish I could get those feelings back again. It was a very tragic thing, because it's a wonderful hymn. And there's another great hymn that was written by a man who, for some reason, I got an echo of my voice in studio. Let's keep that echo out. There's another famous hymn by a man who kind of went a little bit nuts and went to Jerusalem and claimed that he was the Messiah. So yet it's a great hymn, and it's sung in all the churches, and it's in all the hymnals. Now, what I would say is I sing those hymns to the degree that I resonate with those hymns. I sing psalms, too, even though David, who wrote them, committed some great sins, though he did repent. But he was an imperfect man, And so I would just say, you know, the songs that we sing should be songs that are chosen for their content, not because we know something that we don't like about the person who wrote them. Now, if a person who wrote them was a, you know, a Satanist or something like that, then of course there would hardly be anything in it we could ever approve of, so we wouldn't have that. But there are Christians with a lot of different views out there. Now, the NAR, especially up in Bethel, has been known to do some strange occultic-looking things. Now, they don't think they're occultic, apparently, but they mimic the occult in many respects. And that being so,
right,
I'm not very happy with the NAR movement. I would not encourage people to become part of that movement. I would say there's some dangers in it. It takes some discernment. But on the other hand, not every song that was written by someone there would necessarily be infected by bad spirits. You just have to decide. I mean, if a pastor and elders were looking at the songs that the worship leader was suggesting and saying, hey, these words, you know, we don't like these words, we can't agree with these words, or even, you know, every time I hear this song, it kind of gives me the creeps, you know, I can't quite say what it is, can't quite say what it is about it, but I get the creeps whenever I hear it. I think, let's not do that. But if it's a song that the words are something that a godly Christian would resonate with, which are uplifting, and no one is discerning a bad spirit from it, I don't spend too much time worrying about the character of the person who wrote it, although I do wish that every songwriter had the good character of Isaac Watts or Charles Wesley or, you know, Newton or, you know, some of these guys. They wrote great hymns, and they were great men. And a lot of Fanny Crosby, you know, a lot of great women wrote hymns too.
Right.
So I mean, I like to know that the person who wrote the hymns is coming from a pretty deep place in their spiritual walk that I would envy being in, and I can maybe somewhat approach it by and enter into the spirit of their own Christian walk somewhat by, you know, singing the words they wrote. But that doesn't mean that every song I would sing would have to be written by somebody who. Whose biography as a Christian would be enviable.
I appreciate your opinion, and I know you need to take another caller, but I just want to say my husband and I listened to a lot of your lectures, and we really appreciate how you teach.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that, too. I appreciate that people do listen to those lectures and tell me things like that about them. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right.
And
God
thank you for
Shirley.
Your word. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye, sister. James from Garland, Texas. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Hi, James.
Hey, Steve. How you doing?
Good. Listen, you're kind of echoey. You're kind of echoey. You on speakerphone?
No, let me get out of this empty room. Okay. Ah. Is that better?
Probably. Go ahead.
Well, I want to talk to you about baptism.
Okay.
If you look at the book of Acts from Pentecost, or actually you look at the Great Commission, go make disciples baptized. You look at Pentecost, repent and be baptized. You look at the examples of Philip and the eunuch. You look at Cornelius and his household. All these examples, once they heard the gospel, they were baptized immediately.
Yeah.
And you said the other day, I was listening, you said that we're baptized into Christ, which is the way I believe it.
Yeah.
And so why have evangelical churches strayed away from that to where it's like, well, if you want to be baptized, or we're having baptism Sunday. So my question is, to me, baptism is a part of salvation. It's obedience to what Jesus said do and what the examples were.
Yeah.
And to me, it's necessary for salvation. I don't think it's optional. Now, sure, somebody get killed in a car wreck on the way to baptistry and all that. You know what I'm saying?
But right. If you're on your way to get baptized, you get killed in a car wreck and you don't get baptized, that doesn't mean you're not saved. But if you have received Christ and embraced him as Lord, then you should be told immediately that baptism is the first step he requires to be taken, and you should do it. Yeah.
Not the way it is.
Well, that's true. I grew up in a church that was called Baptist, which you'd think, well, they'd have a good emphasis on baptism. They're Baptist. But they only had baptisms occasionally, several times a year. And they'd let people, of course, I don't know if they had people get saved any more frequently than that. It wasn't a Baptist church that had a lot of conversions. So, but it's obvious that You know, they did not say, okay, now that you've received Christ, let's go to the water, which is what the early church would do and what the churches should do. I mean, if they're going to follow the example of Jesus or the apostles, that's certainly what they'll do. They'll baptize people the same day as they're converted and see that as part of the whole process. Now, I think you asked why they don't. I have to say, and it's not a good answer, but I have to say, I think it's out of convenience. I think that there's only certain times when they want to fill the tank with water or go down to the beach or to the lake or whatever they're going to do with baptism and get wet. I think they like to schedule special occasions for that and try to just pile all the people who are interested in baptism in. Now, you're right. A lot of times pastors will say, if you want to get baptized, you know, then let us know. We'll, you know, at our next baptism, you can be baptized. Well, what they should say is if you want to be saved and you haven't been baptized, well, then come on up today and we'll have a baptism this afternoon. You know, there, unfortunately, we have churches full of people who have been evangelized but have not been baptized. Now, that you'd never find a church like that in the first many centuries. They baptized people. Well, I shouldn't say many centuries, because the Didache, which was written at the end of the first century, actually did suggest that sometime that they had adopted a policy of people fasting before baptism. But we don't know if they fasted for days. They might have only fasted for the hours from their conversion until their baptism. We don't know how long the fast went, but it may be that they began to deviate from the apostolic practice. I'm always in favor of doing the apostolic practice whenever that's possible. So, you know, the church, if they tell people, come forward, accept Jesus into your heart, and say a sinner's prayer, of course, they're in those words, they're not saying anything the Bible says. The Bible doesn't say anything about saying a sinner's prayer or accepting Jesus in your heart, but it does say to get baptized. Unfortunately, churches that would argue that they are following the Bible, in fact, they often would boast that they are the ones who do follow the Bible because they're evangelicals, they often will tell people things the Bible nowhere says when it comes to, here's how you get saved, accept Jesus in your heart. Well, the Bible doesn't say that anywhere. Walk forward, no, the Bible doesn't say that either. Say a sinner's prayer. No, the Bible doesn't say anything about that either. Be baptized. Well, the Bible does say that, but the preachers don't say that in many cases. So, I mean, if you go to what's considered to be a Bible-believing church, and they've told you that you have gotten saved by saying a prayer, but they haven't insisted on baptism, well, then they're not a Bible-following church. I mean, they might in many respects be, but then all churches follow some things in the Bible, or else they probably wouldn't call themselves a church. But it's a pretty important thing, I would think. So I think you're raising that more as a rhetorical question, raising it more as a stating an objection to the practice. I have the same objection. It may be inconvenient when someone is led to the Lord that they get baptized immediately, but for many decades, whenever I led someone to the Lord on the street, or we even at our school, the police would sometimes drop off transients at our school in the middle of the night. We'd stay up for hours and seek to lead them to the Lord. And if they did come to the Lord, we had a lake on the property. We'd just go out in the middle of the night and baptism in the lake. We just thought we'd follow the biblical pattern instead of making it up as we go along. And, you know, I remember leading people to the Lord in Santa Cruz on the street, going out in the ocean and baptize him. That's what the early church did. And, you know, I'm not saying that it'd be the end of the world if you waited till the next day to baptize them, but to give them the impression that baptism is something that can be put off, or that it's something that is optional and you do it when you feel like it or something like that, is to totally misrepresent the biblical preaching on the subject. So, brother, I think I'm on your side about that. Thank you for your call. Okay, let's talk to George from Southfield, Michigan. Welcome to the Narrow Path, George.
Hey, thank you, Steve. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I have a fairly easy question. You know, as we just taking a look at how God dealt with the failures of the priest from Israel, from the Israelites. You know, by the time the New Testament starts, Jesus picks 12 disciples, and if I'm looking at the scriptures right, I've been able to identify that, you know, Paul was from Benjamin and, you know, Matthew was from Levi, right? And my question is that are there other evidences of the other disciples that came from this, you know, this ethnic Israel group?
From the various tribes?
From the various tribes, yeah.
Right. Well, we don't know, or we do know that Saul was of the tribe of Benjamin because he says so. We don't know exactly what tribes the others were of, but it is believed that Judas Iscariot was from a Judean town called Kirioth, and it is thought on that basis, since it's a Judean town, that he might have been of the tribe of Judah, but we don't know because Jewish people from all over the place, from all over Israel, had, you know, relocated places. Now, to say that Matthew was from the tribe of Levi, you're saying that because his other name was in fact Levi, and you'd think if Levi is one of the names of one of the 12 tribes, which it was, that parents would, if they're going to name their child after one of the tribes, they'd name it after their own tribe, Levi. And so that's a very good possibility. However, there were numerous disciples named Jude or Judas, which is a Grecian form for Judah. There was Judas Iscariot. There was another Judas, not Iscariot, they called him. And there were some other Judases in the Bible. But those two among the 12, they might have been from the tribe of Judah because their names were, in fact, Judah. But there'd be two from that tribe then, maybe three if you include Judas. Judas Iscariot, sure. And then, no, just two. Then Simeon, also Simon. There were two Simons among the apostles, among the 12. And Simeon, or Simon, was one of the tribes as well. So, you know, if we judge by their names, then there was one of the tribe of Levi, at least, who was Matthew. There were two from the tribe of Simeon, who were the two Simons, Simon Peter and Simon the Zealot. And then there'd be two from the tribe of Judah, which would be Judas Iscariot and Judas not Iscariot. And that leaves several that we don't know what tribes they were from. And we can't be 100% sure that those who had those names were necessarily from those tribes, but I think it's a reasonable, I'd say all things being equal, that would be probable. That's how I would assume it to be so, but we could be surprised someone might name their child after a different tribe.
Question, you know, and this is the last part of my question that I'm going to ask, you know, it was really obvious when you read the Old Testament scriptures that, you know, God chose Israel as their priest. He wanted them to be a witness to the other nations, right?
Yes.
And so, right. And so I guess, you know, when I'm looking at it, if I'm looking at that question, just digging a little deeper, when you say you assume, are we saying that I haven't been able to find any scriptures that's particularly attached them to Israel, even though I know God chose Israel as his mouthpiece.
Wait, that a tribe, that connects who with Israel? The 12 apostles?
What's your question one more time? Make sure I understand.
Yeah, well, you said you don't see anything that attaches them to Israel. Who? The 12 apostles?
So, no, that's what attaches them. Yeah, I get that the fact that they're...
Well, what are you saying? What is your question? What is your question, then?
So they're the children of Israel, right? And they're supposed to be these witnesses, right? And okay. So are there particular scriptures that attach them that show you exactly where, or is that we're just assuming that they are from the tribe, from the 12 tribes? Because I haven't been able to find anything.
They're Israelites. All Israelites were from the 12 tribes. There were only 12 tribes of Israelites, and all people who were of the 12 tribes were Israelites, because that's who Israel is. Israel was the 12 tribes. Now, if you're asking me, were they all Israelites? Yes, of course. I mean, Jesus hadn't done any evangelism among Gentiles. If Jesus had had a Gentile among his disciples, that would have been a huge controversy that we never read of coming up. I mean, he was criticized for a great number of things, including the fact that his disciples didn't wash their hands properly and things like that. But he was never criticized for having a Gentile in his 12, and certainly he wouldn't Well, he wouldn't without getting that criticism. That criticism would have been very much in the forefront. Furthermore, even after Jesus had gone back to heaven, the 12 apostles still weren't sure whether Gentiles, as Gentiles, could really be part of the church. That was something they had to decide at the Jerusalem Council. So in other words, it's clear that none of the 12 were Gentiles. None of the people who followed Jesus in his lifetime as disciples would have been Gentiles. Jesus had contact with some Gentiles. There was a centurion who Jesus healed his servant from a distance, and there was a Syrophoenician Gentile woman who had a demon-possessed daughter, and Jesus healed that girl from a distance too. And in both cases, he commented on those Gentiles having exceptional faith, but they weren't, welcomed into his apostolic circle, nor did they seek to be. I mean, he did some favors for Gentiles who had great faith, but he didn't include them in the circle at the time. In fact, to the second case of that, the woman, he said, "I'm not yet sent to anyone except the house of Israel." So he clearly hadn't gone to Gentiles. So, of course, all the apostles were of one or another of the tribes of Israel. Now, I'm not sure if your question is this. There's 12 apostles and there's 12 tribes. Is there one from each tribe? Do we know? Do the scriptures tell us what tribes of Israel each of these were from? And the answer is no. No, we don't have that information. So, and we know Paul was from the tribe of Benjamin. He wasn't one of the 12. So he came up later on. So the answer is, depends on what your question is. If you're asking, do we know that they were Israelites? Of course, they had to be Israelites. There were no Gentiles in the movement at that time, nor for some period of time later. Do we know if there was one of the 12 for each of the 12 tribes of Israel? We don't know that to be the case. That'd be a very interesting thing to know. I mean, if it was so, it'd be very cool, I think. But the fact that we're not told that there was, and no issue is made of them being that way, I think we probably can assume that there were not, that they were probably not necessarily picked one from each tribe. All right, let's talk to Anthony from Napa, California. Anthony, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. I had a quick question. Actually, it's multiple questions, but for the same topic. When Jesus was resurrected and he showed himself to his disciples, there, in a couple instances, there was... like when he showed himself to Mary, she didn't know who he was. She thought he was the groundskeeper.
Right.
And then when he showed himself, when he was on the shore, they were like afraid to ask if it was him.
Right.
And I was just wondering, what you thought about that, because, yep. I figured if they walked with him for 3 years, daily, they would instantaneously, in my mind, I would recognize him, right?
You'd think so, wouldn't you? You would definitely think so. So it does suggest that after his resurrection, there were things about him that didn't look quite the same. It was the same person, and he showed them that by showing that he had the scars in his hands and his feet and the spear hole in his side. So it's very clearly the same person, but his appearance apparently was changed. You're right. I mean, yes, I have thought about that. We don't know what to say about it, except that Mary Magdalene didn't recognize him at first. The seven fishing apostles in chapter 21 of John didn't recognize him at first when they were in the boat and he was on the shore giving them instructions about where to fish. They didn't know it was him until John said, "It's the Lord." Then they knew. When they came ashore, it says none of them dared to ask him who he was because they knew it was the Lord. That's strange. Strange wording. They didn't dare to ask him who he was. It means there was some question in their mind. Maybe they're still having a hard time with the concept of if he's really resurrected or not. The two men on the road to Emmaus didn't recognize him, and they seem to have been people who had been disciples at some level of his. So it is a strange phenomenon. It's interesting the Bible doesn't explain it or make anything of it. It just mentions on several occasions that people who should have recognized him for some reason didn't. And sometimes he had to prove to them who he was by showing them his scars. But that shouldn't surprise us much. I mean, it is when Jesus was glorified on the Mount of Transfiguration, his appearance certainly changed. And therefore, when his body was glorified in resurrection, there could have been some significant change in his appearance, improvement, I would assume. But, when you see somebody and they don't look the same as last time you saw them, even if the changes are slight, I mean, if you see someone and they've put on weight or lost weight since you saw them last, or they've gone bald or they've grown a beard or something, sometimes you think, wait a minute, you do a double take. Is that really my friend there? I haven't seen him for 20 years. Who knows? Jesus may have had certain things about him like that that look different. But we don't know what they are. Again, the Bible doesn't explain that. It's a reasonable question to come to the mind. But it's one of those questions we have to live with the I don't know kinds of answers for it. I appreciate your call. We are taking a break at this point just to let our listeners know that we are a listener-supported ministry. The Narrow Path is the name of the ministry. If you'd like to write to us, you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. You can also, if you want to donate to help us stay on the air, you can go to our website, thenarrowpath.com. Everything at the website, all the resources are free to take, but you can donate at thenarrowpath.com. I'll be back in 30 seconds. Don't go away.
The book of Hebrews tells us, do not forget to do good and to share with others. So let's all do good and share The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg with family and friends. When the show is over today, tell one and all to go to thenarrowpath.com where they can study, learn, and enjoy with free topical audio teachings, blog articles, verse-by-verse teachings, and archives of all The Narrow Path radio shows. And be sure to tell them to tune into the show right here on the radio. Share listener-supported The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. Share and do good.
Welcome back to The Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live for another half hour coming up. If you'd like to be on the program, the number is 844-484-5737. Our next caller today is Kimberly from Sacramento. Kimberly, welcome.
Hi, Steve. I have a quick question. I wanted to know about preterism, the difference between preterism and partial preterism. Mm-hmm. I am retired and on fixed income. So I went to your lectures, and my phone, internet is not that great. So it's like I could never get through to be able to listen to that lecture on that.
Wow.
It's the internet on my phone because I don't have internet at the house or cable. Anyway, so I'm just wondering what the difference is between partial preterism and preterism.
Well, the word preterism refers to a belief that a certain prophecy of Scripture has been fulfilled in the past. The word preterism comes from the Latin word for past or beyond. We've gone beyond that, so it's in the past. So a partial preterist is someone who believes that part of the prophecies of the Bible have been fulfilled in the past, but not all of them. A full preterist is somebody who believes that all the prophecies of the Bible have been fulfilled in the past. Now, that means that a full preterist doesn't even believe that there's a future resurrection of the dead or a future second coming or a future new heavens and new earth. They spiritualize all those things, and they think they all happened in AD 70. This view is a very new view. It arose in the mid-20th century, and it has spread as an internet phenomenon primarily. Some of the leaders of it have written books, but I don't think their books are exactly bestsellers. But people who find them on the internet sometimes read their books. I've read some of their books because I've had to refute them. I've actually written a book contrasting full preterism with partial preterism. It's called Why Not Full Preterism? And I think it's a pretty thorough book on the subject. You can get it at Amazon. It's called Why Not Full Preterism? If you look it up under my name, Steve Gregg, you'll find it there. Now, partial preterism believes that some prophecies have been fulfilled in AD 70. Remember, the full preterists who think all prophecies have been fulfilled, they think they've all been fulfilled no later than AD 70. But the partial preterist still believes there's some to be fulfilled. The partial preterist still believes there's a future second coming of Christ and a future resurrection and a future rapture and a future new heavens and new earth. In other words, they believe what all Christians have always believed. Full preterism denies what all Christians have always believed prior to the 20th century. So the reason partial preterists are sometimes called that is because there are some of the passages that a partial preterist sees as already fulfilled are passages that maybe most Christians have not seen that way, have seen them as relating to the end times. And in particular, that would be at least parts of the Olivet Discourse, Matthew 24, and its parallels in Luke 21 and Mark 13. Part of that, part or all of it, partial preterists would see as fulfilled in 70 AD. I see part of it as fulfilled in 70 AD, not all of it. Likewise, the book of Revelation, a partial preterist believes that parts of, maybe most of, Revelation has to do with AD 70, though not maybe all of it. Though a partial preterist could, and some do, probably, believe that Revelation is only about AD 70 and that the Olivet Discourse is only about AD 70, but they would still believe there's a second coming because Paul talks about it in 1 Thessalonians and 2 Thessalonians and 1 Corinthians and 1 Timothy and other places. I mean, Paul does, and other, Peter talks about it and so forth. So, you know, a partial preterist would be called that instead of just being called like any other Christian, because even though a partial preterist does believe what all Christians have always believed about the second coming in the future, the partial preterist believes that there's certain passages that are not talking about that second coming, but which have mistakenly been seen to be talking about it. And therefore, they would take, you know, as I say, part or all of the Olivet Discourse and part or all of the book of Revelation as being about AD 70. But they would still believe that notwithstanding those books and those portions being about AD 70, there's still other passages that tell us about a future second coming of Christ and resurrection of the dead and rapture and new heavens and new earth and so forth. So just to make it real simple, whenever you read any prophecy in the Bible, you need to decide, has this been fulfilled in the past or does it still have to be fulfilled in the future? Now, many prophecies, it's very easy for Christians. We read about the Messiah going to be born in Bethlehem. We read about Messiah riding into Jerusalem on a donkey. We read about the virgin, having a child and so forth. Now, those are prophecies in the Old Testament, and we believe those are already fulfilled when Jesus came. So we are preterists. All Christians are preterists about those prophecies. But there are other prophecies that not all Christians are preterists about, but some are. And that would be, you know, some of the ones that are written in apocalyptic style, which makes maybe the average person, especially the one who's not familiar with apocalyptic style, maybe it makes them think that must be talking about the end of the world, when in fact, the context of the passage makes it fairly clear that it's not talking about the end of the world. So the partial preterist is going to take somewhat more prophecies than the average Christian takes as being fulfilled in the past, and therefore comparably fewer as waiting for a future fulfillment. But the full preterist goes all the way and says they're all fulfilled in the past. There's no future fulfillment. So that's the primary difference between the two. If you're interested in looking at the arguments of each side against each other, my book, Why Not Full Preterism, would be one place you could research that.
Okay. All right, great. Thank you, Steve.
Okay, Kimberly, thanks for your call. All right, Crystal from Detroit, Michigan, welcome to the Narrow Path. Uh-oh, I'm not hearing you, Crystal. Going once?
Hello?
Oh,
hi,
there we go.
I'm sorry. I'm a new listener. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
And I love this program. I listen with my kids every day now. So my question is, I was just wondering, is it permissible to go to Jesus and ask him to convey a message to our loved ones that passed? My mom died in 2020, and I was just wondering. I know that you're not supposed to be going, if you're a Christian, you don't go to soothsayers or I just was wondering, could you personally go to Jesus and ask him, he can convey a message, and can they know, and can they know of the message that the Lord is sending them or no?
Right. Well, I have to say, we don't have any information about people doing that, and therefore I would not be encouraged to do that. I suppose you could ask Jesus anything you want to, and if he can say no if it's not something that's okay. Yeah. So, I mean, if you say, hey, Jesus, would you let him know this? You know, the truth is that what we think it might be good to let them know is probably something that they already know if they need to. You know, the Bible doesn't tell us to think much about or at all about communicating with the dead. And as you say, you know, going to seances and stuff like that is strictly forbidden. But you have to ask Jesus to tell them.
Just to say I love you, you know, say, Mom, I love you, you know. I just didn't know. I just want to make sure I'm doing the right thing.
Okay. The Bible doesn't tell us that doing that would be okay or do any good, but it doesn't say not to do it. So if you want to get that off your chest and say, Lord, would you tell her that I love her? Then I'm not going to say that he'll say, okay, sure, but he might. Never know. Right. Never know. That's up to him.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, and I enjoy the program.
All right, Crystal. God bless you. Thank you for your call. All right. Our next caller is Corey from Lincoln, Nebraska. Corey, welcome.
Hi.
Hi.
So I was hoping that you I'd like to understand a Bible story about, I think it was Noah, where they discovered the tent, and then the oldest son, and then the two younger sons come in and backwards and everything.
Yeah.
As to,
that's in Genesis 9. Uh-huh.
The effort to not shame him, and then I'm trying to understand why he was so upset and why that was maybe included.
Okay. Sure. Well, let me just say the story is given as the occasion for Noah's curse on Canaan to be recorded. Now, the Canaanites descended from Canaan, and they were under God's curse because of their wickedness. And eventually God commissioned the Israelites to go and take the territory from the Canaanites and drive them all out and even kill them all. And so the Canaanites were under God's curse at a later date. This story in Genesis 9 gives occasion to report that Noah actually pronounced a curse on Canaan. Now, Canaan was his grandson, the son of Ham, one of the sons of Ham. Ham was Noah's son. Canaan was the son of Ham. And the Canaanites came from Canaan. So that's how the connection is made here. Now, some people say, well, why did Canaan get cursed for what Ham did? Well, we don't have any record of that being the case. Canaan was cursed. On this occasion, a prophecy cursing Canaan was made, but it nowhere says it did that because of Ham. It says when Noah knew what Ham had done to him, he uttered this curse on Canaan. Now, it doesn't mean that it was because of what Ham did. I believe the curse came on the Canaanites because of what the Canaanites did. But it gave occasion for a prophecy. Now, this prophecy, Noah wrote Genesis, of course. And Moses. Moses wrote Genesis. Moses was leading the children of Israel as they're on their way to conquer Canaan. At least they thought. And so for him to let them know that way back, just after the flood, there was a divinely inspired prophecy against Canaan, would be simply showing, hey, it's been for a long time, these people have been under God's curse, and we are now escaped from Egypt, we're going to go conquer their territory and carry out this curse that God wanted. Now, as far as what happened to lead up to this curse, Ham came into his father's tent for some reason and saw that Noah had gotten very drunk and was passed out, and he was unclad, he was unclothed, he was laying on his bed naked and in a very undignified way. Now, Ham, of course, could have just covered him up, as a respectful son would do, so that if anyone else came in, they wouldn't see him in that condition. And he could have just done that quietly and walked out and never said a word about it, and it would have been his way of, you know, preserving his father's dignity and not spreading the news about it around and so forth. Instead, he didn't cover his father up. Instead, he went out and told his brothers about it. Now, why he told them, we don't know, but it was obviously gossip. It was obviously a disrespectful news about the father. The fact that he didn't cover his father up when he could have might have said, hey, you guys should go and see him in there. What he's, you know, like, it was just a very disrespectful response to seeing his father in that condition. And the other two brothers didn't share Ham's disrespect for their dad. They did respect him. They knew that if they were in that condition, they'd want somebody to quietly cover that up and not talk about it. And they were going to do the same for their father. So they put a garment over their shoulders and walked backward into his tent. They knew where his bed was located. So they walked backward in there and tossed the garment down over the bed, which meant over their father. And then they left. So the idea was that, you know, the man had done something embarrassing. His younger son didn't make any attempt to cover it up, but rather to kind of make sport of it. The older brothers were a little more respectful, considerably more, and wanted to cover him up, and they just left. Now, when Noah woke up, he realized what Ham had done. Now, some people want to suggest that Ham had done something else besides what is recorded. Some have tried to suggest some sexual activity or something like that, which is, to my mind, entirely unjustified from anything in the passage. If there had been something like that, probably the passage would have mentioned it. Sometimes people say, well, in Leviticus, you know, when you sleep with your father's wife, there's an idiom that says that's called uncovering your father's nakedness. Well, that's true. There is that idiom in Leviticus, but it's not found in Genesis 9. There's no reference to Ham uncovering Noah's nakedness. Actually, the idiom is absent. It says Noah uncovered himself and was naked. There's no reference there to Ham doing anything about that. And then, of course, the two sons came in and literally covered him up, which means that his uncovered condition that's mentioned earlier is literal. It's not an idiom. So, you know, people try to make it more purulent, somewhat more sexy, something more perverted than it really is. And I'm not sure why people like to read those things into the Bible, but I don't. I'd rather read what's actually there. I don't think any such thing happened. I think that Ham's sin was to disrespect his father, to talk about his father's exposed condition rather than covering it up and keeping it a respectful secret. And when his father knew what had happened, that simply was the occasion of his cursing Canaan. Now, Canaan was not cursed because of what Ham did. But it may well be that Ham's bad character gave occasion for God to inspire Noah to know that Ham's offspring, especially of the Canaanites, were going to have particularly bad character enough to come under God's curse and become slaves of their brethren, Japheth and Shem. So, you know, it's an interesting old story, very ancient, but I don't think there's more there than what we read. Some people look for more. But I would just take it at face value and say, I think what it says is all that it really means. So I hope that may help. I appreciate your call. Pardon?
He's being shamed. Well, I never really understood why he was being shamed, but I get it now because what Ham did is why he was upset.
Yeah, he was upset by Ham's, basically exposing his shame to the brothers, which of course, I mean, some might say, well, Noah, shame on Noah. Noah's the one who put himself in that position. Why should he be angry at Ham? Well, it's true. I mean, parents sometimes do things that they should be ashamed of. But if their kids go out and broadcast it to the world, they should be ashamed of doing that. There's such a thing as honoring your father and your mother. There's a lot of famous celebrities whose children have written books, tell-all books about all the shameful things their parents did. That's sort of like what Ham did on steroids. It's absolutely disrespectful to the parents. When a couple has children and brings children into their home, that mother and that father are inviting witnesses for the next 18 to 20 years into their home to see everything that they do, good and bad. And therefore, the kids are privileged. They have privileged information that outsiders don't know about the good and the bad that their parents do. Now, all parents are human, so they do good and bad. But the children who are witnesses of the bad, as well as the good, are the parents are now vulnerable to having their reputations destroyed by their children. But there's a command, honor your father and your mother, you know. And obviously, children do know things that their parents have done wrong. And they could make it public, like Ham did. But that's not honoring. And so, you know, this is a violation here of the fifth commandment that Ham was guilty of. And I don't know that it's anything more than that. Okay, let's talk to Tim from Utah. Tim, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, yeah, no problem. I just had a follow-up question about the baptism that we heard earlier.
Mm-hmm.
So about 4 years ago, I accepted Christ in my life, and I was in a jail cell. And one of the things that I was worried about is, you know, what if I die in here? Like, well, will I be able to be saved? I mean, that kind of – and people were pointing out scriptures to me, and they were saying the thief on the cross, how he didn't get baptized. And then also in Matthew where John the Baptist is, you know, leading the way for Christ, he says, the one who comes after me will baptize you with the Spirit and fire. So my question is, because I'm getting baptized here on the 31st, I've made up my mind
good
about that, but
good,
what would you tell people that believe that they don't have to be baptized, that they've already been baptized with the Spirit, like I used to believe?
Yeah, being baptized with the Spirit is a reality, but it's not the same thing as being baptized in water, and it doesn't replace it. You know, when the house of Cornelius in Acts chapter 10, they were all filled with the Spirit and spoke in tongues and prophesied when Peter was preaching to them. So they'd been baptized with the Spirit, and Peter's statement was, "Who can refuse water to those who've received the Spirit as we have?" And he commanded that they should be baptized. So it's very clear that the early church did not consider baptism in the Holy Spirit to replace water baptism. In most cases, water baptism came earlier. That is, in rapid succession. For example, Paul in Acts chapter 19, he led some people to Christ. He baptized them in water, and on the same occasion, after they came out of the water, he laid his hands on them, and they were filled with the Spirit. So baptism in water and baptism in the Spirit are not the same thing, but they are both part of what Christians are supposed to have. When Philip was preaching the gospel to the Ethiopian eunuch in Acts chapter 8, the man spontaneously said, "Well, here's some water. What prevents me from being baptized?" So obviously, and it says they went down into the water. So clearly, baptized in those circumstances are referring to being baptized in water. But they do not cancel out or in some sense replace being baptized in the Holy Spirit. Now, when you're in prison and you receive Christ, if there's no opportunity to be baptized in prison, then your situation is not very much different than the thief on the cross. He received Christ in his dying breath. He didn't really have any occasion to be baptized. God is not going to bust a person on something like that when they have no choice in the matter. God saves you because you give your heart to Christ and because you've surrendered to him as an obedient servant. But an obedient servant, if he happens to be nailed to a cross or in a prison cell and can't get baptized, you know, God's not going to say, "Well, look at that, I caught you in a position where you can't get baptized, so you're going to hell." No, that's not God's mind toward this. The idea is that obviously most people who are led to the Lord are led to the Lord on an occasion or in some situation where baptism is not impossible for them. And I'm glad you're out of prison, and I'm glad you're going to be baptized this month. So congratulations on that. You know, it wouldn't hurt you to be baptized today, but you've already made the arrangements, so I'm not going to fault you for that. Yeah,
that's the soonest opening they had, and it was funny that you mentioned that it's about convenience, because I believe that too.
Yeah, so. I think that's the thing. I mean, the church doesn't follow the biblical patterns on this. They don't baptize people the same day. So a person like yourself who wants to be baptized, it's not your fault if you don't get baptized till the 31st, because the church won't baptize you before then. I got saved when I was a kid, but the church I went to wouldn't baptize me till I was 12 years old. And so I was for several years a believer without being baptized. I wanted to be baptized, but they just had a policy. Now, you know, I don't think God penalizes the believer who wants to be baptized. And I mean, not if you get if you lead someone to Christ on the street, or someone leads you to Christ on the street, and they walk away, I mean, okay, you might say, well, I want to be baptized, but now what do? You don't just walk up to a stranger and say, would you baptize me right now? You know, you need to have someone who's got some water and who's willing to baptize you. And in the early church, that wouldn't have been a problem because the same person who led them to Christ would have also led them into the water. When we don't have the churches obeying Christ in the same sense today, then the person has got to do what they got to do. And it sounds like you're doing what you got to do. You've scheduled your baptism for the soonest opportunity, and God knows that.
Is there churches out there that are really like that, that you can find that do that? Because
there are churches having trouble finding
a church.
Yeah, I will say this. The Church of Christ is a movement that really, really strongly pushes baptism. And I wouldn't be surprised if they'd baptize someone the moment they converted. But there are different kinds of Churches of Christ. They all stress baptism, but not all of them have excellent dynamics in their beliefs. I mean, some of them are rather cult-like. Some are not. Some Church of Christ are not at all cult-like, at least the ones I've met. Some of them are not. Some of them are. So, I mean, I would just say, oh, just go to a Church of Christ. They'll baptize you. But not all of them can be recommended. Some of them could. I would just say, you know, you're a few days away from it. God knows you've scheduled it with the only person you know who will baptize you at this point. So just go for it. And you know, if you happen to die before the 31st, I personally don't think I don't think you'll be penalized for that, since you're making your plans and hoping to, you know, you've got it planned.
Awesome. Cool. I appreciate you taking my call, and I love your show, man.
All right, Tim. God bless you. Thanks for your call. Chuck from Tustin, California. Welcome. Chuck.
Hey, Steve. How you doing?
Good. We don't have but a couple minutes, so go ahead.
I got it. This should be an easy one for you. I was contemplating the other day what I had heard, and it's something I never really thought about before, but Jesus basically introduced the world to the Trinity, you know, and before that, there was no real concept of it. So current Judaism, okay, contemporary Judaism, do they have a take on the Trinity? What is it?
Yeah, the Jewish faith does not believe in the Trinity, just like the Muslims don't. Muslims, Christians, and Jews all believe in what we call the Abrahamic God. That is the God that made promises to Abraham. They all say they believe in the Abrahamic God. But only Christians recognize that Abrahamic God as being three persons. Both Muslims and Jews see only one person, and therefore they reject the Christian idea of Jesus being God in the flesh. Muslims reject that. Jews reject that. It simply is not part of their theology, never has been, and neither group has seen fit to alter their theology to conform with Christianity. And that's not too surprising. We haven't altered our theology to conform with Islam either. So, I mean, Judaism and Islam are both anti-Christian religions. That is, they both reject Christianity. They both reject Christ. So the fact that they're not Trinitarian is not the greatest of their woes. The greatest of their woes is that they reject Christ. Anyway, yes, it was reasonably easy to answer. Thank you for that call. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg. We are listener-supported. If you'd like to help us pay the radio bills, and that's what gets paid. You donate, the money goes to radio stations, period. There's no other expenses, no overhead, no salaries here. You can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Or you can go to our website, thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. Let's talk again tomorrow. God bless you.